Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Migration and Diaspora Podcast, produced by Homelands Advisory, your independent migration agency. And in case this is your first time tuning in, we spotlight projects, research, and stories, and everything else related to people on the move. Today, we've got a true heavyweight of the migration world, Rob McNeil, with us on the show to get his take on contemporary public debate on migration. And first, a bit about Rob and his truly fascinating career trajectory that has led him into the migration field. Rob is the Deputy Director and Head of Media and Communications at the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford, where he leads on public relations strategy, parliamentary and community outreach, and news and commentary work. And Rob was also part of the team who launched the observatory in 2011 as well. And since then, he's been working to embed its analysis in public debates. Rob also participates in Oxford University and its Centre on Migration Policy and Society, Compass's research projects, examining the social environments from which news stories and narratives about migration and migrants emerge, how media debate affects migration policy decisions and vice versa, and how information gaps affect how these issues are discussed. And he also lectures on migration and the media for the University of Oxford's Master's degree in Migration Studies. Rob is a former journalist and previously served as media director for the US environmental organization Conservation International, as PR manager for Oxfam Great Britain, as senior press officer for WWF UK, and as a journalist for the Evening Standard, the Daily Mirror, Time Out, and BBC Wildlife, among many other publications. That's quite the track record. And in today's far-reaching, perhaps meandering interview, I learned from Rob's extensive media and academic experience studying migration narratives and debates, especially in the UK and Europe, although there are, of course, many parallels with other countries. We discuss the nature of these migration debates and, in particular, which factors seem to lead to more balanced and less toxic debates on migration. And I'm sure you'll agree this is a very timely conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed having Rob on the show because he not only speaks from his eminent position at the Observatory, but also draws from his experience working on different topics in different countries. I'd like to thank Rob for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. And without further ado, please sit back and enjoy the episode. Mr. Rob McNeil, hello and welcome to the Migration and Diaspora Podcast. How are you and where are you calling in from?
I'm extremely well, and I'm speaking to you from the Centre on Migration Policy and Society at the University of Oxford, which is unsurprisingly in Oxford in the UK.
Not Oxford. Oxford, is it Oxford, Ohio? Oxford,
Missouri? Oxford's all over the south of the US, and I'm sure there's one in Australia. But we're not that one. We're the one with the dreaming spires.
And what's your own migration and diaspora story, Mr. McNeil?
I have done some migrating in my time. I moved to the US. I lived in America for a couple of years. My origin story is quite shaped by migration. I think everybody's origin stories are quite shaped by migration in one way or another. My father grew up in Lancashire. He was a McNeil, so the McNeil family began on the Isle of Barra in the Outer Hebrides, and then actually my dad's side of the family went to Canada and was in Canada for a few generations and then came back to Liverpool, where my father's father met my grandmother, who was Irish. She was a McKiernan. On my mum's side, my grandfather was quite British, but my grandmother was, so this is the thing I think that really made a big difference in my view of the world. My grandmother was born and brought up in Morocco. She was born and brought up in Tangier, and she had a family that was extremely international. So she was from a British family living in Tangier. Her father worked for the US embassy there. They all grew up speaking multiple languages, and her sister went off, moved to Spain. So I've got this whole Spanish wing of the family. The other brothers and sisters did come back to the UK, but they lived this life which was quite defined by having grown up speaking multiple different languages and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's definitely shaped my life and my own family as well. My brother lives in France. My sister lived in France for a while. My brother lived in Italy as well and Spain. So there's a big mix of people moving around. The world's pretty global these days, really.
Would you identify as part of the Irish diaspora or the Scottish diaspora, or both, or neither?
I'm a sort of, I'm a mutt. I think we're all mutts in one way or another, but I'm very English, really. I mean, like, if I, My efforts to assert my Scottish heritage tend to bump into a bit of a brick wall if I ever go to Scotland, because the Scots don't seem to want me to be one of their own.
So you didn't celebrate Burns Night last night?
I may have had a couple of drinks last night, but we don't need to go down that route too much.
Okay, great. Well, very interesting to hear about your background, and let's talk more about your role now.
Okay, so I have a sort of slightly peculiar role. I'm the Deputy Director of the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford. I was part of the team that put the Migration Observatory together back in 2010. It's probably worth just explaining quickly what the Migration Observatory is and what it does in order to then explain what my bit of that has been. For those who haven't come across it, the Migration Observatory exists to inform public debates about migration in the UK in an international context. So primarily we're focused on UK migration data and policy making, and on understanding what we do and do not know about these things. And there is a very strict rule that we do not make policy recommendations. We are not there to tell people what policy should be. What we are there to do is to tell people what the data actually does say about migration, and to do analysis that then helps to allow people to make reasonable decisions about what policy should be. So that's for the policymakers to do. We don't tell them what to do. We just make sure that there is clarity about, as I say, what we do and don't know about migration to and from the UK in an international context. There are multiple dimensions of that. That brings us then to the bit that I do. And my own kind of like little kind of niche in this. In order to do that, I slightly have to go back in history to what I used to do. So I began my career really as a journalist, and we can come back to that in a little while. And I was a journalist for the best part of a decade. And then I went into doing strategic communications work for NGOs. And I was working the reason I migrated to America in the first place was to work for a big environmental NGO in the US. And I was doing that when the job here in Oxford came up, which I was very excited about. I thought I'd have a go at doing it. And when I came in, the original conception about what the observatory would do was very much situated in an academic sort of understanding of what was needed. We would just provide a sort of almost like a clearinghouse for data. Do you know what I mean? And we would provide the accurate information, and journalists or policymakers or civil society could then come to us and get it, and that would be great. But the bit that I identified in this, and I think that other people had seen it too, and in fact, Martin Roos, who was the original director, Carlos Vargas Silva, who was one of the original researchers, Scott Blinder, who was one of the original researchers, they all kind of felt the same about this. But I strongly felt the issue with migration is often not just about the data, it's actually about the storytelling. It's about how the data is presented, the story that is then provided to embellish or to construct that data into a kind of narrative, into an understanding of things. And that actually the issue isn't that people are getting the numbers wrong. The issue is that there are certain ways that these stories are being told and that we need to be engaged with that. From my perspective, it was very important that the Migration Observatory was, in order for us to inform public debate, we had to be part of public debate. And so to be part of public debate, what we had to do was to tell stories about this data in a way that was compelling and that was valuable and useful to the people who were then essentially amplifying the information, right? So we had to be working with the media, we had to be working with policymakers, we had to be working with civil society, understanding where they were with this information, and then making sure that when we identified interesting information which we felt should be in the public domain, that we told a story about that that was compelling and interesting, and that actually meant that it would appear in the news. It wouldn't just be something that academics knew about that nobody then took any notice of. That was very much my role, and coming from that journalistic background, I strongly felt that we should do that in a way which was accessible. So there's that sort of proactive side of things. And part of that was also thinking about how we even put together the basic things that we do. So the briefings that we provide so the Migration Observatory basically provides kind of subject-specific briefings on components of migration. primarily. I mean, that's the sort of the core of what we do, the briefings that we do, which deal with everything from, I don't know, you know, like the sort of fiscal impacts of migration in the UK and what we do and don't know about that from the various data, through to, you know, input, you know, what we do and don't know about or can or can't measure about something like integration. We developed a structure for the reports that we did, which was quite fairly accessible. I mean, it's still quite, this is Oxford University. We're not, this isn't sort of children's television program. We're not telling stories in ways that are super simplistic. But what we are doing is trying to make sure that, I mean, we sort of pitched it as something that we thought, if you're doing like an A-level in history or sociology or whatever, you should be able to read these things and basically know what, you know, understand it, right? And actually, for anybody who's got a reasonable level of education and reasonable understanding of how the world works, you should be able to, and when I say reasonable level of education, I'm not talking about degree level or anything like that. I'm talking like if you've passed your GCSEs or if you're basically capable of reading and understanding things, you should be able to read a Migration Observatory report and understand it. And part of that was recognizing that we needed to remove, for example, right, firstly, that we had to keep it simple at the beginning. So you just say, this is what we're talking about, and here are the key things you need to know. And then there's a lot more information underneath that. But also we removed a lot of the stuff that would generally be in academic analysis of something. We didn't get rid of it. We put it in separate sections. So, for example, the caveats which say, this is contested and you have to know this in order to know that. And maybe this data is complicated because of this, that, and the other, right? We took that and we put that in separate sections. So things like an understanding the evidence section, an evidence gaps and limitations section at the end. So these are separate things that you can delve into if you need to get more deep, right? If you need to get deeper into this stuff. But it facilitates people reading effectively the story of this data without feeling like they're getting sent off down rabbit holes that make them confused about where they should go with stuff. And a lot of it's about presentation of data in clear and coherent ways. So lots of it is focused on like data visualizations and stuff like that. And so that's the sort of core of what the Migration Observatory is and what my role in it was and still is, which is that kind of that storytelling component of this stuff in order to facilitate understanding.
Yeah, I think it's also important for listeners who may not be from the UK to know that the Migration Observatory at University of Oxford is extremely influential in the UK. And it is, as you've said, you do present things, I think, in a very, both a nuanced way, but also a way that's simple enough for the generalist to understand. So I certainly enjoy reading it myself. I'm wondering, how hard is it to both use data to tell a story without going as far as being prescriptive? Because I don't know, I just recalling some of the articles from the Migration Observatory that I've read, and sometimes it kind of seems like you say, oh, there isn't evidence for this, that, or the other, without then explicitly providing policy recommendations, but you're kind of implicitly recommending policy in that way, no?
There is one area of policy that I suppose we do get into, which is statistics. If the statistics aren't good enough, if the data is not good enough, then we do say this needs to be improved, right? You need to do better in this area. But it's more that kind of like there isn't a right or wrong. I mean, the problem with migration, well, with lots and lots of policy issues, but migration is a good example of one. There isn't a right or wrong way of doing it, right? There isn't such a thing, I would argue, as objectively good migration policy. What there is something which some people think is good migration policy and other people might strongly disagree with, right? There isn't a right or wrong way the world can or should be run. And there are lots and lots and lots of organizations out there on the left and right that basically tell you what their view of how the world should be run is and why that is, right? And our job is not to do that. In fact, actually, it's the explicit value that we bring to this is that we do not do that. We do not try to tell people how to do it. And it creates a ground on which there can be agreement about what the data say without it being something that means you feel like you're being battered into submission, into basically having to agree with a particular perspective on things. And it is challenging. I mean, it's difficult to do that because you've got to remove your own biases and prejudices from what you you're doing. You've got to say, I may not agree with what's going on here, but it's not my job to say what I think should happen here. It's my job to say, what does the data tell us? What do the data tell us? Data being plural. Sorry, I should do that. What do the data tell us? And what can we conclude from that, irrespective of our position on this? And there are things, right? I mean, there are things that the data can tell us which might, in my opinion, clearly indicate that one should go X way or Y way with this, with that policy making. But that conclusion is a step too far. That's the thing that we can't do. And to do that is problematic. And it's very interesting to see how our data is taken by people who may have really like different perspectives about how things should be done to me. And it gets used in ways that I look at and go, oh, right. Oh, yeah, I see. That's how you perceive this. And at the end of the day, much as I may not particularly, that may not be the way that I'm going to go and vote. I look at that and think, well, okay, that's how people are interpreting this. And that's okay, because that's a grown-up discussion about this kind of stuff using an agreed set of data. So, I mean, I'm not sure I'm answering your question. It's really hard to do it. Of course, it's hard to do it. And it's hard. And also, everybody wants to claim that we are biased in the direction of their opponents, right? Or that we are on their side. But we're not. So, I mean, it's kind of the raison d'etre of what we do. And I love it. I love it because in such a complex and contested policy area, it means that I don't have to know what to do about it. That's for politicians to fight about, right? And I don't have to make the choice about what is the right or wrong way of doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well said. And well, whether you answered the question directly or not, it nonetheless, I think, provides a good segue to the main topic of the day, which is about migration debates and how we can make them better. Oh, you did neglect to mention your other role, which is as host of your own podcast, the Migration Oxford podcast.
That is true.
Which I think is an excellent podcast. And there's some really interesting episodes that I can also link to in the show notes about AI and migration management and a whole host of other emerging and very kind of timely and relevant migration issues.
Yes, that's a really important part. That's part of my role here at the Centre on Migration Policy and Society. So as well as being the Deputy Director of the Migration Observatory, I have this kind of role as the sort of media, as the sort of communications director for the Centre on Migration Policy and Society. And so I do that podcast with Jackie Broadhead. And it's wonderfully edited by our communications officer, Delphine Bogie. It is good fun. It's a really interesting thing to do. And it's also, again, I mean, it's something that takes me into places that the Migration Observatory just never does take me. And one other thing that I also do as well, which I should mention, because I think we're about to get into something that's relevant to that, is I do personal consulting on migration and media related issues for various other organisations as well. I think we may be about to start dipping our toe into some of the stuff that I've done in that direction.
Absolutely. I was just looking at a glossary that you developed for the International Centre for Migration Policy Development just this morning. But yeah, let's get on to the topic of the day, which is about migration debates and how we can make them better. Let's first define what we're talking about. So what do we mean by migration debates? Debates between whom? Via what platform? What medium? Etc.
Debates are debates, aren't they? I mean, anybody having a conversation about migration in which they're putting forward a perspective on how things should or shouldn't be done, what the rights and wrongs of this are, you know, that these are migration debates. I don't think that there's a limit on what they are. They are, you know, like humans talk to each other in various different ways and through various mediums of communication. We're kind of talking about all of that, but I suppose my area of interest, considering my background in journalism and strategic communications and stuff like that, tends to be mass media discussions about this sort of thing. And mass media is even the idea of mass media is complex and slightly contested these days, particularly with the emergence over the last couple of decades of social media as this sort of behemoth of discussion and discourse and what have you. But, or these behemoths, even multiple behemoths. I mean, that's a lot of this. But also, I mean, policy discourse as undertaken by policymakers through media of mass communication. These are the areas that I'm very interested in. I've done a lot of the researchy work that I've done while I've been at Compass and that I'm still doing now has tended to be focused on these kind of mass media things. So questions like, for example, what are the role of journalistic practices in different countries in creating different types of migration debates? And what does that then do in terms of affecting policymaking? Or what may that then mean as far as policymaking is concerned? But also just like broader questions about like how do policymakers engage with issues and what does that lead us to in terms of the nature of discussions about migration, the way that we understand the issue? That's a very long-winded answer to your question. But basically, is anyone talking about anything?
Okay. And so what are some of these big observations that you've made about migration debates and particularly things that you perhaps find problematic and that constrain as society, as media, and in the public policy domain, having useful and healthy debates about migration?
I did some papers recently for the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung and the Federation of European Progressive Studies. So that was a consultancy job that I did. It wasn't a Compass job that I did, which was looking a little bit at the kind of the slightly upside down way that policymakers, particularly policymakers who are trying to push for more kind of open or liberal policymaking on migration, the challenges in the way that they engage with the debate, which is sort of built into the way that we discuss migration as a whole, so left, right, whatever. And that is to do with the fact that migration as a subject for media is perceived as a problem. It's not something that's discussed as, I mean, like those of us who work on the issue look at it as this kind of broad thing that A has always happened as far as humanity is concerned, and that is defined by certain sort of like political constructs like the nation state and you know, like balances of power and also economics and blah, blah. So we look at it from multiple different dimensions and we think about it as this kind of big complex issue that is you know, like that has brings positives, negatives, and is done in good ways and bad ways, and it's blah blah blah, all that sort of stuff. But the media discussion about migration, and obviously there's an array of different ways that it's done, but primarily migration is discussed in the context of a problem to be solved, right? Whether or not, I mean, even, you know, like, even if you're looking at what you might see as kind of positive migration stories, you know, stories about like need for migrant labor in order to facilitate economic development, as opposed to something about the need to stop migrants coming in because they're sort of like consuming all of our welfare budgets or whatever it may be, you know, that sort of story. Both of them are kind of framing the concept as a problem. And the overall discussion about migration is undertaken in the context of this idea that it's a problem to be solved. And that creates a challenge particularly for those who are pushing for a more kind of like liberal perspective on this kind of thing, because that fundamental kind of agenda of migration's a big deal, right? And therefore we need to do something about it, right? It means that we end up in a situation where the policy response is to try to do something about migration in one way or another, right? And so even if you are going in and saying, migration's great, what you're doing is amplifying a story which says migration's a big deal. And therefore the kind of the automatic sort of like overall big picture response to that from a policy position is we need to do something about migration, which from the perspective of the majority, I think, of people that consume storytelling about it means we need to stop this, or if not stop it, we need to have better control over it. It's not well managed and there's a problem here and we need to do something about that. Sort of like so there's this kind of like ironic process that emerges where even when people are pushing forward a kind of positive story about this, it ends up basically saying to people, this is a big problem. There's this kind of like bizarre strategic problem for people in this. That's a rather kind of simplistic description of one of the things I wrote in one of these papers for the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung. And I think that we can see evidence of how this kind of thing actually works when we look at, for example, what happened in the UK after Brexit. And this is a really interesting thing to look at, I think. And I mean, there's always a challenge in doing the kind of correlation versus causation thing here, but I still think it's worth kind of like investigating this particular issue, which is that in the run-up to Brexit, migration as a sort of policy issue, the salience of migration was through the roof. It was commonly listed as the most important policy issue by people on things like the Ipsos Mori Issues Index and stuff like that. People saw migration as a massive deal in the UK. Naturally, there had been a lot of policy driving that forward. The net migration target that the Cameron administration had introduced, the hostile environment policies that were being championed, all this kind of stuff. All of these kinds of like policy solutions to the big problem of migration, right, had ended up kind of like sort of finally reaching this kind of endpoint where one of the stories that was told, in fact, actually using commonly migration observatory data, was EU migration to the UK is out of control. We have to do something about this. And people responded by voting for Brexit, right? In the immediate aftermath of that vote, basically migration as an issue in media, and I really felt this. I mean, I'd gone from basically being rung 50 times a day by journalists, it just fell off a cliff. Suddenly, I sat in my office with kind of like, I mean, I had things to do, but it wasn't answering phone calls to journalists about this. And it was a very surprising and weird space to be in after years of this just being everybody's focus. And migration went from being on the front page of every newspaper every day, from leading BBC articles, all this kind of stuff, to being really a peripheral issue as the UK grappled with a world of complexity that was introduced by the sudden decision to do something quite radical in terms of its kind of geopolitical sort of space that it was in, and the economic implications of this, all of this sort of stuff. Plus, net migration was ticking down. It started sort of ticking down fairly soon after that, certainly according to the data. So it was no longer this situation where this rapidly rising net migration stat was still there as a symbol of the loss of control of the borders and all this kind of stuff. Actually, realistically, net migration didn't really change that much after that. It continued at similar-ish levels. But public concerns about migration over the sort of 2 or 3 years that followed Brexit just really, really notably declined. Suddenly, it was no longer something that you saw in the Ipsos Mori Issues Index. It dropped out of the top five. It was, when you started asking people questions about, you know, do you think migration is good or bad for the UK? So Pew did some research in 2018, 2019, where they looked at across European countries, you know, like which countries thought that migration was good or bad for the country in different ways. How did populations see migration as sort of positive or negative for the country? And in Europe, the country that was most positive about the benefits of migration to the nation was the UK. So there's this extraordinary shift in public attitudes, which has actually been maintained, I think, in quite even. And I think, yeah, a bunch of other things, like, for example, the Windrush scandal and all of that sort of fed into a little bit a broad softening of public attitudes to migration during this period of time. But I think the fact that basically it was no longer like front page news all the time, just absolutely blaring out of every news agent you go into, because you didn't even need to buy the newspaper to still, you know, that ambient news experience that you get from just being somewhere and seeing stuff and turning on the TV and getting kind of fed these ideas. That suddenly, migration was no longer top of the agenda and public attitudes softened. And with public attitudes softening...
Sorry to step in, but to what extent do you attribute that to the fact that migration probably slipped down the list of priorities for the country, versus some people also would suggest that that's also one of the benefits of Brexit, in that at least when the public feels they have more control
over migration
policy.
I would agree, but those two things are intrinsically linked. If you're no longer being fed a message that says this is out of control all the time, then that sense that it's not out of control is reinforced. What we need to remember is that these things are two sides of the same coin, basically, that actually when people stop being fed a message that something is completely out of control, then that that concern about the issue declined. The reality is that, you know, like, net migration did not fundamentally shift after Brexit. And in fact, if you look at where we are with net migration now, you know, which is like in the, you know, 670,000 or whatever it is, vastly higher than it was pre-Brexit, then, you know, you can see that
it is coming back onto the agenda now, I feel. You know,
it is coming back onto the agenda. But my point is that the overall message seems to be, it's not about actually specifically what the numbers are. It's about whether or not people believe that something is being well managed and is under control and is being deliberately done in a positive way. 200,000 Ukrainians or whatever it was coming in was not perceived to be a problem from a numerical point of view, even though that was, you know, vastly, you know, that sort of exceeded the net migration target in itself. And even, you know, BNOs, Hong Kong BNOs, these were things that were seen as managed flows. It's this idea that something's out of control and this constant message that something's failing that feeds into that concept, right? So what I'm basically trying to say is that storytelling about these things, and when you tell a story to people which says, this is a big problem, migration is a big problem, then people respond by feeling like it's a big problem. And these kind of ironic processes, I think the overall point of what I'm trying to say is that challenge for organizations trying to put forward more liberal perspectives on migration is that they feed that beast by even saying, no, it's not a big problem, migration. Let me tell you about migration. It's actually good. It still feeds into an idea that actually, that migration is a big deal. And you can see these kind of ironic processes also occurring on the other side, right? I mean, there's this the version of this where, so do you know about the identitarian movement, the hipsters with kind of a very strongly far right position on things? Do you know about the identitarian movement? It's a sort of far right youth movement, and they did a review of some of the work they did to try and stop the maritime rescues in the Mediterranean in 2017. They did this analysis, right? And their analysis, right, and they had been attacked ferociously across the board by, like, liberal media in Europe about what a terrible organization they were. Their review of their own campaign actually states something along the lines of, I can't remember the exact wording, but it's basically like, the coverage we got in the media about our campaign massively helped us to achieve our goal. All of the coverage was lies, in inverted commas, is what they say, i.e. it was saying that what they were doing was bonkers and mad or completely unacceptable. That drew attention to what they were saying and created some public support for the mission, for the mission that they had to stop these maritime rescues from going on. So it's understanding that the strategic intervention in these things by organizations to try and bring about better outcomes, a really well-organized strategic intervention would actually be for organizations to just shut up about it, for it to drop, for the issue of migration to not be a massive public policy issue because it's not something that people are freaking out about. That would be the strategic way of doing things. But the problem is that that's also unstrategic for those organizations if their objective is to draw attention to how effective their work is or why the thing that they're specifically working on needs to be understood. It's a complicated situation. It's a kind of like, it's an intractable space. But it's kind of, I don't know, I think it's pretty interesting.
So I suppose this all feeds into one of your central points of your writings, which is about the need to turn down the volume of migration debates.
Yeah.
And I'll also link to some of the articles that we're referencing in the show notes. And what are the implications of that, though? As you said, it's challenging for an organization to not talk about what they're doing and to not advocate for what they believe in. So how do you actually do this? Because it's an observation.
Yeah, I mean, this is, as I say, this is an intractable problem. And I'm not telling you the answer to it, right? I don't have the answer to it. Just like I don't have the answer to what a good migration policy is, right? But I think that there are things that people can and should do, right? One of which is not making claims that are not essentially symbolic. Governments developing symbolic migration policies is problematic. Things that are not designed to achieve an actual outcome and that are not demonstrably going to get there are problematic. They erode public trust in issues. And equally, NGOs and organisations making claims about things that will solve a problem, that will not solve that problem, are really, you know, that's it's a similar thing. So, for like, basically trying to counter a simplistic argument that says, like, we should stop the boats on one side with something which says, no, what we need to do is have more safe and legal routes on the other side. Those, neither of those two work, right? The safe and legal routes argument, there are lots of arguments for safe and legal routes. Sorry, let me clarify that point, sorry. There are lots of arguments for safe and legal routes, right? But those arguments are not that they will effectively stop the boats. And if you should read, I mean, Jeff Crisp's piece for Mixed Migration Review.
I know what article you're talking about, and I'll link to that. It's very...
Yeah. So this makes the very strong point that the people that are going to get, that would be able to access the safe and legal routes, are not the same people that are taking the dangerous, that are making the dangerous journeys. So it's all very well to argue for safe and legal routes as a solution to, as a solution to, you know, to small boat crossings in the Mediterranean or the UK or to the UK or whatever. But the evidence isn't there to support the idea that that'll work. It might well improve a lot of people's lives in various different ways, but it's not going to stop the boats, and so it's not going to do that job of saving lives. And there's Crisp's argument is actually that it may actually do the opposite and actually encourage more people to take these risky journeys, because it creates better networks and better ways of doing this, you know, better ways of integrating into, you know, the receiving society and stuff.
Yeah, I'd also add to that category that here I'm just thinking more about the UK, but, you know, one side of the political spectrum is very much stop the boats, as you've said, and often conflating the irregular arrivals by sea with the high numbers of legal migration, and using terminology such as illegal migrants and so on and so forth. And then the left side also, I feel, at least I'm still talking about the UK, but there's parallels with other countries, also presents perhaps a misleading view about how you can smash criminal gangs and you can do some return agreements, and then that also addresses the perceived issue as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we'll train our way out of the labour demand that we have that encourages migration. You know,
yeah.
These are simplistic arguments. And I think that the fundamental thing that sits at the heart of all of this is that, as we said at the beginning, migration is something that, like, since there have been human beings, there has been migration, right? People have always moved. It's something that is part of the human condition. It's part of what it is to be a person. The interest in going somewhere else for various reasons, ranging from just pure curiosity to necessity, right? So people are always going to move. It's a thing that's going to happen. And so the idea that there are solutions to a problem, this simplistic concept, is fundamentally problematic, and we need to move away from this way of describing things. And politicians need to stop making simplistic claims about fixing something which is far more complex than cutting taxes. It's not as simple as that. It's more complex. So I think that's a sort of core part of this whole thing. And I think your point about language is really important as well. Honest language, honest discussions about things, accepting that some things are, that you do not have answers to some problems, is very difficult for policymakers. But it's necessary if we want to move away from the situation that we're in of kind of like these, as I say, this simplistic, symbolic policymaking being put forward. I don't have the answer, right? There isn't a clear and easy strategy that means that you can get from, you know, like, that means that suddenly we're going to be in a situation where everybody agrees that this is how we should do things and that'll all be fine. Because fundamentally, this is a contested thing. This is about how should our societies feel? What are the choices we should make about how life is in the places that we're at? Who shouldn't have rights? Who should have rights? And these are not things that everybody agrees on. And that's the problem, is like, you can't magically solve that.
Yeah. And how would you interpret the way that things play out in the UK? And by that, what I mean is, if you look back, the situation you described after Brexit, where the salience of migration as a policy issue perhaps fell, was that perhaps because just other things happened, like we were dealing with the economic fallout of Brexit and then obviously COVID, Ukraine, etc., etc., so people were just focused on other things? And then as a follow-up to that, now migration is back on the agenda, first with the issue of irregular arrivals, increased number of irregular arrivals by sea, and then now pretty much record high net migration, regular migration levels as well. I mean, is that not just, I mean, is that all just an immovable situation in the sense that migration was off the agenda for those reasons that are completely out of government's control? And then, you know, irregular arrivals by sea come up. So then people get annoyed by that. And then government's kind of forced to react. Politicians are forced to react, etc. So how do you actually change that?
The issue with irregular arrivals in the UK, I mean, this is something you can trace. I mean, like this particular set of things that are going on at the moment, this has been an ongoing challenge that the government's been wrestling with for, you know, two and a bit decades. You know, go back to the late 1990s, the early 2000s, and the Blair administration's negotiations with the French government to close the Songat refugee camp, all of that kind of stuff. You know, there's a contiguous suite of things that have happened, efforts to try to stop these flows happening that have been unsuccessful. They've been unsuccessful because at the end of the day, it's just not a very doable thing. Stopping the boats entirely, but there weren't boats before. I mean, like, or at least there were a minuscule number of boats before. I mean, what we're talking about is stopping flows of irregular migration across from France into the UK. And I mean, this began, I mean, the story back in 2000, or in 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, was about the Songat refugee camp. And it was about the fact that, you know, like the asylum seekers were, you know, the British media narrative about this was largely focused on the idea that asylum seekers were being offloaded by France into the UK, and that France had cynically placed this refugee camp in, like, right by the Eurostar tunnel, and this is why they were taking these risky journeys on Eurostar, you know, like grabbing onto Eurostar. And I mean, in fact, I had a conversation, I was a journalist at the time of this, and I had a conversation with my brother who was living in France at the time and still is actually now, where I said, this is extraordinary, why is that, you know, well, I didn't know, and I wasn't involved in migration policy at those point in time. I said, how can the French government be so cynical about this? It's, how, you know, it's such a transparent sort of approach to trying to offload people, because that was the narrative that I'd consumed. And my brother, very, you know, like, it's one of these conversations which kind of flips something on its head. And my brother said, no, Rob, don't you understand? The refugee camp's there because that's where the refugees are. And if it wasn't there, then they'd be sleeping in the field, which was obviously the French story about this, because that's what he'd been encountering. And of course, it made me see the issue totally differently. And I realized for the first time, having not looked deeply into the issue at that point in time, what was going on there. And what's fascinating is that that's exactly what happened. They closed Songat, and the emergence of the jungle happened quite rapidly after that. The emergence of this kind of like shanty town. You know, you didn't have an organized space for people. So you had this shanty town emerging that created a bunch of problems. You ended up with people then, like, using lorries and trucks and ferry journeys to try and get into the UK that way. Massive investment in the juxtaposed border controls, securitization of the port of Calais, which then helped to prevent that from happening. But you know, having moved the problem from one place to another, that securitization process then moved the problem somewhere else, because a few people tried to come across in boats. That worked. It's much harder to control because you haven't got a bottleneck that you can kind of like seal. Instead, you've got a kind of shower head along the northern French coast, which just can, you know, like vast number of people can travel from. And that was very difficult to do. So it just demonstrates the intractability of these sorts of challenges. There isn't a quick fix. And the problem that we have with a lot of this discussion is that people imagine there is.
We really have hardly scratched the surface, but we've tried to scratch the surface, and I've at least enjoyed myself, and hope you have too, and hope listeners have enjoyed listening. We'd love to have you on again to continue this, but for now, thank you so much for joining us, for coming on the show. And before we leave, how can listeners connect with you and learn more about your work?
Well, the Migration Observatory, you can follow us on Twitter at @migobs. Sorry, it's X these days. Sorry, I have to do it correctly. Anybody who really wants to get in touch with me personally can get a hold of me at robert.mcneil@compass with a single S, @compas. .ox.ac.uk. I'm happy to chat to people, but also super busy. So if I get absolutely swamped, if you've got your millions of listeners, Loxan, then that might be slightly challenging, but people are very welcome to do that. And the Migration Observatory is migrationobservatory.ox.ac.uk. Compass is compass.ox.ac. So that's with a single S, .ox.ac.uk. And you can, you know, you can Google us.
Links to all that and more in the show notes. Rob, thanks once more and all the best for 2024.
Loxanne, lovely to speak to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Migration and Diaspora podcast, powered by Homelands Advisory, your independent migration and diaspora agency. If you've enjoyed the show and would like to support our channel, please feel free to share it or leave a review via your preferred podcasting platform. You can access the channel's full archive and show notes by visiting homelandsadvisory.com/podcast, where you can also get in touch if you'd like to be on the show. Thank you again, and see you next time.